I'm Laura Harper Lake.
And I'm Sarah Reitzman, and you're listening to Creative Guts.
Hey, listeners, thanks for joining us for this episode of Creative Guts. This upcoming episode is one of the earlier ones we recorded. However, it is coming out now because it took so long to edit. We had a fascinating and extremely long, in-depth conversation with the talented Beth Wittenberg, and it was a huge challenge to edit down this conversation for podcast length.
It was worth the wait, though. This episode was recorded months ago and is still my favorite interview to date. Beth is compassionate and thoughtful and courageous, and she talks about everything from religion to politics to vandalism in this episode. All the things you're not supposed to talk about.
Yep.
More so than anyone else I know, Beth uses her art and creativity to tell stories and to talk about things that matter. So without further ado, let's get to the good stuff. Here's Beth Wittenberg.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast, Beth.
My pleasure. It's exciting, actually.
Yeah.
I'm nervous, but it's exciting to be able to talk about something that I'm passionate about. So, and actually have an audience. I mean, I don't know if there will be an audience. There'll be a huge audience. So, but, you know, as an artist, that's what I want to do is communicate. So
yeah.
If this is the way that I need to reach viewers, mm-hmm. then I, by all means, bring it.
Absolutely. And I've known you for like 5 or 6 years from various, you know, art events and stuff, but I feel like you always stick out in my mind because your art is incredibly vibrant, but your personality is beaming with positivity and you're very magnetic. You have a magnetic personality. And so I, you know, you were one of the first names that came up. You ooze creativity.
I agree. And I've known you for like 20 minutes.
That's a huge compliment.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting because people either like me or I'm kind of polarizing. There are mm-hmm. people that are not so fond of my, like I said, I'm my conversation style is sort of, I'm an like it's the Inquisition. Like mm-hmm. I want to ask you so many more questions about you than I want you to ask me about me. I don't know if you've found this with many artists that you're interviewing and working with, but that, you know, this vocally is what is my biggest challenge mm-hmm. as an artist to be able to say what it is that I'm creating visually. But this kind of communication and dialogue, this is what is most interesting to me because I get to see what my brain is doing. I not see it, but I get to hear what mm-hmm. my brain is doing. And so I like a lot of times in my artwork, I'll use text. And I sort of riff off my own brain.
Yeah.
So it's like wherever, like this conversation, wherever you guys take it, that's where it's going to go.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it sort of has its own organic path.
Yep.
Exactly. And that's just my creative process. Sort of like I was saying before, paint on acetate, it's going to slide off. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, what I love, you know, Bob Ross made that like happy accident thing. He made it very positive and people, you know, jumped on board mm-hmm. but my art education was all about happy accidents. My professors when I was an undergraduate and when I was a graduate, they were not interested in what my skill level was. They were interested in the content of my work.
Mm-hmm.
They encouraged me actually to have no skill, to be untrained. You take a drawing class, Beth, you draw the way you draw.
Yeah.
But I want to draw the way other people
the
draw.
The masters, I want to get exactly. good, quote unquote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get good. And they're like, you are good. You mm-hmm. just need to continue. And that, you know, I got my degree in philosophy first, and then I went back post baccalaureate and got my art degree, and then I waited a few years. It actually took me like 13 years to finish undergraduate school, but I got a couple degrees out of it. So, and then I waited a long time before mm-hmm. I went to graduate school, but it was like that was what I was so hungry for, the intellectualism of art. I love that.
So take us back a bit further. What is your first memory of realizing, oh, I love creating, I love inventing, I love dreaming and making what's in my head come out?
That, I've tried to think about that many times and I can't pinpoint it. I know that I liked to color when I was a child, mm-hmm. and that color itself brought me a lot of joy. I know what the teachers wrote on my report cards, which were things like, Beth does not interact with children very well, but she does puzzles and games by herself. Mm-hmm. And sort of, I played with my brother's Erector sets, and I actually was like before Legos, I think. So,
oh, wow.
So, like, I remember being at camp and, like, putting glue, sticking the tongue depressors together.
Yeah, yeah.
So I liked all of that kind of stuff. And then I took art in high school, and I graduated from college I never took an art class until I went back post-baccalaureate.
Really?
And the only reason I did that, my father was like, what are you going to do? 9 years, 13 years, undergraduate school. What are you doing? Dad, I'm going to be a philosopher. I'm going to sit on a mountain. I'm going to think. It's going to be great. I'm going to get paid big, big bucks. So my father was like, you have to do something. And I said, oh, I'll go back to school and I'll get a degree in art. That's the ticket.
How did he respond to that?
Well, he paid for it.
Positively enough.
Yeah, and my parents have been my biggest patrons. They supported me for a long time.
That's
materials,
great.
They always, I have more art materials than God, really. I have a lot of stuff. So my parents have afforded me the opportunity to be an artist.
God bless them.
Right.
That's awesome.
Thank God, really. Because what would I do? I can sit on a mountain and think and paint and write poetry.
And those are kind of interconnected. I mean,
Definitely.
You're pulling, the inner parts of you out through your philosophy into, a representation that someone else can translate into their own interpretation or their own philosophy.
Right. That's what I always feel like philosophy found me, and I always feel like art found me. Mm. It was bound to happen. I was just waiting to collide with it.
Yeah.
So I have one painting before you guys go, I'll show you. It was my first painting that I considered successful as an undergraduate student.
Wow.
And so that first painting was in 1989. So I was born in 1965. So from 1965 to 1989, I did not make very many art things.
Wow.
I took art in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I took a printmaking class, and I just never thought I could do it like other people. So I was discouraged. And then it wasn't until, like I said, college, where they were like, no, really, you are good.
Yeah.
Like, you go do your thing and don't worry about all this other stuff.
Yeah. So. And when I went to school, I had a really great teacher who said, it's the process, not the product, over and over again. And like, I think about it all the time when I'm working, because sometimes I get, frustrated or artist block, or I have like a blockage, I just can't get it out. And I feel like it's not coming out the way I want. And then I'm just like, calm it down. It's okay. Like, just feel what you're feeling here, and it'll, and it works itself out,
It does work itself out.
Yeah.
So do you feel like it's genetic? Was it something you're born with?
That is also very interesting, because I think that it, nature, nurture.
Yeah.
But I think I grew up in a house full of antiques and mismatched furniture and patterns and
sounds like a dream
design. And my mother was a collector, reed hoarder of fine English china. And she had an enormous collection of trio sets. And my mother had collected one trio in every pattern that she could find from this English china company called Ainsley. And I loved the hand painting on the china. And I love the color combinations, and I thought that these were beautiful things. And my parents collected antique furniture, and I was like, I feel like was it genetic? Maybe. My parents kind of like that stuff. And I always remember my mother's, from when I was a young child, took us to museum programs. And so while I wasn't doing art, I was involved in culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, like, I, My parents, we went to the symphony when I was really young, and we went to the theater. And so I had all these experiences. I mean, I feel so fortunate. They're all these great experiences. When I was younger, I thought everyone had them. And then it took me a long time to know how privileged I am. As, you know, I everything was made available for me. So I'm sort of a product of my, you know, my family. Yeah. So I think both. I think both it's inherent and it was also cultivated.
How do you stay motivated to keep creating?
I love your questions. Really, because this is this is what I'm asking myself all the time.
Yeah.
Just recently, I had a home accident. I fell in the middle of the night.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. It was awful. I felt myself going, and so I let myself go, and I thought I was in the direction of the bed. I was not in the direction of the bed. I was in the direction of the door jamb and the floor. And I just gave into it and just threw myself. And I hit my head.
Oh, no.
And I have heard people have concussions, you know. Oh, yeah, you have a little concussion. Don't go to bed, blah, blah. This concussion has been like 3.5 months now.
Wow.
These are my vision glasses. These are vision therapy glasses. They have a different fractal something. They have tape here.
Okay.
And then they're blue lenses, which make my brain feel better. I wanted to show you. So after the accident, I started doing these drawings. And the drawings are very different from what I have been doing. So these are like kind of minimal.
Yeah.
And they're related to what I'm doing, but they're not related. So this is like my concussion artwork, which I was seeing a lot of stars. Things were in neon colors. I was seeing huge color fields. People were had auras. I would see after images that were neon colors and were so bright and so vivid. And I kept asking the doctors, is this because I'm an artist? You know, am I seeing this because...
You see in this way.
Exactly.
This extra dimension of creativity.
Exactly. And that is what I learned about myself, is just that it's like it's pared down, you know, and people were saying, you know, my Instagram, people are like, oh, I love this new work. And I'm like, yeah, I like the new work too, but I like the old work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're an artist. You
yeah.
know? People are like, oh, I like that. Will you do that forever? And
No.
The natural progression is like on to something else.
It just keeps evolving.
This kind of, like, I was seeing colors that were like neon highlighters.
And when this is happening, you know, you're speaking to the doctor and they're saying that's okay or that's normal or that's not.
They're saying we need to get you to see a neurologist to make sure your retina hasn't detached, whether or not you have some kind of brain damage from a brain injury. But the doctor I saw is a specialist in neurology and concussions.
Okay, yeah.
So, and vision. And her specialty really is vision. And the tests that she put me through were just amazing, with bells and the way sound and vision work together.
Oh, interesting.
I was like, what kind of, where am I? This is like so sci-fi.
Yeah.
And she said, the exam was like a 2-hour exam. And she said, after the exam, you're going to be exhausted.
Wow.
And my wife drove me home and I was spent from lights that she would show. And my eyes felt like popcorn. They were stimuli like bouncing around in my brain, and I couldn't calm my eyes down. And interesting in a funny way, like that, like the drawings that I just showed you, they look like my work, but they're like a part of my work.
The drawings are such a fascinating way to process and communicate a health issue.
I haven't thought of that.
It's really,
yeah. There's an artist that I see on like on My Modern Met which is like something I follow on Facebook. And there's a series of self-portraits a gentleman did in the later stages of his life while he was going through Alzheimer's. And you just see the progression of the representation to the non-representation and how he's like losing himself and, you know, the health that is deteriorating. And
I saw that on Reddit yesterday.
Oh, you did? Oh, I did. Wow, that's funny.
That's great that you know it.
Yeah. And I use my art to process a lot. And so it's like the process, you weren't even trying. It just...
Exactly.
It pushed out, you know?
It actually, I think it healed my brain a little to pare down my... my style, which is kind of like layer upon layer upon layers all smashed together into one layer. So that's what I'm constantly trying to do. I'm trying to find a way to represent the entities that I feel in a certain space. Like we're here in this small room. And I think that while we're interacting with each other on this one sort of reality level, I believe there's other levels going on that we don't see, but I know, I feel them. There are other entities and beings in the same space. So when I'm making a drawing or a painting, I am trying to listen as carefully as I can to all of the chatter that's happening in my head. So I work with my friend Andy Heck Boyd. We do a lot of art together in his studio in Exeter, and he likes music on. And I know so many artists that like to listen to music. I like it silent.
Wow.
I like no noise. I like to hear the sound of, like, if I had a pen, you know how it sounds on canvas?
Yeah.
So I like the sort of sounds that the artwork makes, and it becomes almost percussive. I like the beat and the cadence I'm kind of all over the place. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, it's great. One of the other artists we interviewed, Rose Bryant from Art Up Front Street, which is the artist collective of that. She was talking about how the rhythmic motion, the like kinetic movement of placing color on the canvas or whatever, what have you, that's what she's in love with. It's, you know, so it completely is, you know, it's how her arm is feeling in the moment connected to her joint. You know, it was just so interesting for me as a visual artist to hear about all the different processes of how, what motivates people, how it comes out, and how, what is their Zen moment? Why, you know?
Right. Do you have that in your work? Do you have a, because I see your artwork and I love your artwork. First of all, I love
me too.
Your illustration and your graphic design. I respond very positively to both of them, but I don't even know how to craft something that you do.
I don't know how I do it.
You know what I mean? You must have a process also.
Pretty much everything that comes out of me comes from a primary emotion, I would say. Like, I work through, it's like a therapy for me. Like, I work through things.
Like dreaming.
Yes. Yeah. And I definitely do have since I was a little kid, I've had my head in the clouds. So I just dream up these fantastical things. And usually they're connected to an emotion or evoke a memory that is connected to an emotion. So a lot of my stuff has to do with memory and loss and processing that kind of stuff. So I do a lot with outer space and with underwater. And one day it hit me in both of those locations, though in space you may or may not be alive when it's happening, you're floating. Like there's a buoyancy there. And I think because I am a high, stressed, intense kind of person.
Really?
Did you not notice? I must be hiding it.
You're
so
sitting
well.
Straight.
Yeah, I
know. On the edge of your chair.
Yeah. I found a world in which to create where you're as light as a feather. There's no worries. There's no care. And there is this, when I'm creating anything, but when I'm in outer space, space cadet, there is this moment of zen where my brain, I'm not purposely thinking anything. It's just all, I'm just feeling it. And it's so rare for my brain to shut off. You know, in yoga, it's still, you know, they say, oh, meditate. And here's where you know, your shavasana. Blah, blah. And I'm thinking of like 12 things. I can't slow down. And so there's this moment of, especially with painting or drawing that it just all, like, it slows down and it speeds up. And I'm thinking, like, in this other dimension almost. Like, I'm just, my brain feels light.
I feel the exact same way.
Yeah.
I like when I'm lost. Mm-hmm. And I don't even realize that I'm there. And I don't even, like, nothing, you know, I'm satiated. I'm not thirsty. I'm nothing.
You
I'm
don't
just
want anything.
Part, I'm yeah. just part of the art. You know, it's just, there's a good, I don't know. I always feel like I'm listening. Mm-hmm. I'm just in the flow. And a lot of people talk about that, like, in terms of meditation. And I do think that, I'm like you, I process my feelings through my artwork. It's cathartic, but it's almost like you were talking about Rose Bryant and being kinetic.
Yes.
And so for me, that's how a piece starts. That's especially what I like about a large format and large scale is that I can extend my limbs and I can put marks as far as I can reach up to the, you know, as far as my hand will extend and, it, you know, just everywhere.
Yeah.
I can touch it and I can, I like that.
Mm-hmm. And that intimidates me. I can't get there. I work very small or medium, perhaps, if you are trying to be relative, but like.
Or tiny.
Yeah.
Tiny.
And I have done some murals for some folks privately. And,
that's
you know,
so cool.
Yeah. Very so that was really fun. So that's the only real experience I've had with much bigger. And I've tried starting other bigger pieces, and I just can't get to that point where I feel comfortable with it. You know, it's. There's
I mean, I own a few of your pieces of art, and what I like about them is that they are so intimate, and that you hold them close to you, and that they're, I feel you as an artist. I have something that I was going to give to my friend Andy, and I told it was a Polaroid.
Yes.
He painted a Polaroid.
I remember that
on a small tiny disc of wood.
Wood,
and I was like, oh my God, this looks exactly like a Polaroid camera. And I was thinking about the size brush that you must have used to do that.
Yeah.
And when I paint, this is not big enough.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Like, this is not big enough. This is, I'm showing a 2-inch brush. What I like to paint with most often are my hands.
I love that.
Or my hands in rags or something that is... It just primal, you know, it just connects me more to my feelings. I can get it out. It's just like, I don't know, I was going to say it's like throwing a stick, you know, like you're a child and you're walking or you pick up a rock and you just throw it.
Yep.
And it's like, I get like that with the medium that I'm working with. I just want to just like
release it.
Yes.
Like,
it's kind of like orgasmic. It's like, I want the release.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of encourage it, you know, like, I try to listen, but there's times I just want to just do it. But I've never actually thrown paint. Like, I've never done any kind of action painting, like Jackson Pollock kind of thing or dripping or I've never really done that. I've taken the end of a paint stick, put it in a gallon of paint and sort of drew with the other end, but I was never like, you know, I was never curious what happens when you throw paint.
It splatters.
Right.
It sounds fun to me.
Yeah.
I'd like to throw some paint.
You should come over. We'll try it together.
That sounds great. I saw on the guy who does Idiot Abroad. I don't remember what his name is.
I love
but
that.
He isn't that a great show? He does another show that's him experiencing different aspects of our life in multiple cultures. So like one episode will be birth. And so he'll go to different places where they give, you know, there's birthing centers and other countries where they're very different how they're done here. But one is art, I think. And he meets a guy who makes art through punching with a boxing glove. But like repeatedly, so there's a lot of texture and the movement of it really creates these unique, crazy pieces. And I think like, holy cow, that looks so fun. You know, it just
that's
is interesting.
Like exercise and art. I love that.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it is. That kinetic kind of energy. That's the same thing I like about riding a bicycle. You know, it's just kind of you get on it and you just your legs are just moving.
Yeah.
Like
yep.
I'm not thinking anything. I'm just moving my body.
Yep.
And maybe that's what Rose was talking about, you know, just just making the movement is enough.
Yeah. I certainly sometimes hit an artist block or creative block. Like, I just, you know, does the bike ever stop for you? Like, do you ever just feel like, ugh, I can't get it out?
I feel like through this concussion, I have been less productive. I am spending a lot more time on one piece of art, whereas I used to just fly through it. Most of my artwork is typically done between like 30 minutes and 2 hours.
Wow.
And now I'm finding that I'm spending like multiple days on a piece. Mm-hmm. Like even some of the drawings that I showed you with the concussion drawings, those I've some of them took like 3 or 4 days, and I have never created like that.
Are you making decisions differently or moving slower? You know, where's the connection of?
I think what is happening is I just told myself, slow down. Like, this is a time for me to heal and heal my brain. And I have just since 2013, I have gone nonstop art. Like, I have not taken any breaks, and I have just like one series, one body of work after the next, and it like one leads into the other. And I haven't really had a time to stop. I had a big show in October, and it had over 400 pieces of artwork in it. And that artwork was created in a 12-month period. So that wasn't even everything. So, I mean, that bin that's right there, and like most of the pieces that were on the post-consumer packaging, and I am still collecting it. I'm still, like, I had a Band-Aid box today, and I was like, ooh. I don't want to throw that in the trash. That's a Band-Aid box. I'm going to draw on that.
Yeah. I love it. So, yeah, tell us about that series and the found, you know, that process. Okay. Like, how did that get, you know, how were you inspired by that? And how did it evolve to be a normal part of your life?
So I was invited to the University of Maine Farmington has a street fair event. It's called the Water Bear Confabulum. And so I was invited as a guest artist to the Water Bear Confabulum. And I was talking to Sarah, who was the gallery director, and she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I had just finished a series of sculptures out of paper and tape and ashes and these sculptures that I called throwaway people. And so I was using these thrown away objects to initially make these sculptures. And there's one there.
Oh, yeah.
So it's things that I found in other people's trash. It's things that I found, those sculptures. I was walking around Rochester, and I was, like, pulling things out of people's garbage and finding things on the floor, and I started collecting those. So first it was the paper sculptures. Then I went into these found object assemblages. And I said to myself, said to Sarah, oh, I'm going to do the series throwaway people. It's going to be, I'm going to save all the cardboard and packaging that comes into my house for a year, and I'm going to repurpose everything, and I'm going to draw and paint on everything that comes in, with the exception of toilet paper rolls and paper towel roll. Those were too challenging to unfurl.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm not that, but I saved everything, the tags that came off clothing. Like, we bought a lawnmower, I saved the lawnmower box, you know, and I bought a pair of socks and there was a piece of paper wrapped around it. I saved that. And there are pieces of wrapping paper that come in Amazon boxes.
Yep.
I just unfurled it and was like, smoothed it out, and that will be a drawing. So I wanted to just, like, this is, I'm a consumer. This is what I consume. This is just what my wife and I have consumed. And oh my gosh, people, look at consumption.
Yeah.
You know, and I had seen a great exhibit at in Alaska called Gyra. And it was about all the plastic that was being gathered between artists and scientists in the Sea of Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I saw this exhibition of everything that they cataloged, and they were cataloging, you know, the little plastic squares that come on a loaf of bread.
Yes.
They had hundreds in little bags, like all the red ones, all the green ones, all the yellow ones. And enormous wall assembly installations of all this plastic, and I just couldn't believe it. So I was thinking about the plastic, and then I was thinking about the cardboard and the paper, and then my concept morphed a little, and I was thinking about marginalized populations and how we throw people away and how we throw different people away, how mm-hmm. we throw single mothers away, how we throw incarcerated men away, mm-hmm. how we throw away homeless youth, how we throw away LGBTQ populations. Mm-hmm. And so the project took another, it took on another layer of how marginalized people are consumed in America, and how they're thrown away like trash. Mm-hmm. And so I was making those kind of connections for myself. And I started noticing that a lot of my drawings, I didn't notice this while I was doing them, but when I was looking back to hang the show at the University of Maine, I was seeing all these people. There was tons of skulls, tons of teeth, like gnashing teeth, and like hands that were all extended, like, help, help. And so it was when we were hanging the show, and I said to the gallery director, I was like, Sarah, I had not even noticed that, like, all of my work, it's the same thing over and over and over. I've got 500 pieces of art that are, they might say different words, mm-hmm. but I'm saying the same thing over and over. And I felt, at the end of the year-long project, it was like I was done. Mm-hmm. I was sick. I was done. But then, just the other day, I made another one. So it was like, it was like, it,
in wow. this pile. Wow. And this is on the back of a Christmas tea box.
Yes, right. I am holding spiced chai.
So, and I want to show you this one.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Paper toilet
seat covers.
Where did you steal that from?
That was from a bathroom. I love the shape of the...
Yep. Oh, sure.
Like, I took the last toilet paper, the last seat cover, and I was like... Box? It says paper toilet seat covers? I love this.
Yeah.
Oh, that is fantastic.
I love the face, the eyes.
Thanks. I like that too.
In the mouth.
So there are some pieces on the packaging that, like the tea boxes, it was so interesting to go through afterwards. We were trying to decide how to hang the show, and I said, I'm going to separate everything out. I'm going to show you how much tea I drank. I'm going to show you how many protein bars I ate. I'm going to show you how many boxes of cereal I ingested. And I started laying things out. And the director, the gallery director, Sarah Mullane, said, the ones that are the most interesting are the irregular shapes. Mm-hmm. And I said, agree. The shape bore the drawing. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah. So I love those, but I also like the ones that are just, they're just on square cereal boxes.
Yeah.
And she said they're not visually interesting enough. The surface isn't visually interesting enough to keep those all together. So, because I wanted to show, the show was called Consumed, mm-hmm. and I wanted to show
every piece.
I wanted to show every piece I consumed, and I wanted to show, I not only wanted to show the drawing, but I wanted to show the object. Mm-hmm. So if I show the work again, which I intend to show it again, I want to put everything between plexiglass.
I was just thinking something like that. Yeah.
And I
yeah.
want to hang these big, giant things of plexiglass.
Oh, my God. But that would look awesome.
The gallery that I showed, it was three stories. So I don't know where I'm going to get a place to be able... I need a warehouse
yeah.
to show
yeah.
like the plexiglass. I've had a lot of shows, and I've had a lot of small solo shows, but this was the first gallery that I ever exhibited in that was not interested in selling the work or the saleability of the work. They just wanted to educate their population and exhibit my work. And yeah. this is like my dream come true, because I'm not interested in selling my work. If you want to buy a piece of my work, come and ask me, and I'll probably give you a piece. A lot of people say I give artists, do this bad rap thing for artists, that I should be selling my work because that's what I do, and I'm an artist. And I feel like these drawings have been freely given to me, and I am glad to put them out in the universe and make them available for anyone who wants them.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I could see this in, say, like an abandoned store or something, to like go back in full circle with that consumerism sort of theme.
I love that. Like an abandoned, like, supermarket.
Like a Macy's or a Oh, yeah.
The mall.
The mall.
That's
the
half
mall.
Empty.
Yes.
Three quarters empty right now.
Right. Sears just went out of business. Yeah. Like, let's.
Exactly. Those are the kind of venues I feel like artists need to start tapping.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I went to Sears and I said, you know what, I want to have like a one night pop-up event. I want to advertise the heck out of it. I want to get a bunch of people there. I just want to make a magical event. And who's going to say no? You know, you're going to bring people into the space. We're going to bring people together. If you want to, I'll do a talk on inspiration. You know, let's make it an event.
Yeah.
You know, I'm happy to do that.
I went to an exhibit down in West Palm Beach, and I'd have to look it up to remember exactly what it was or who the artist was, but it was fascinating. It was an abandoned Macy's. There was an escalator in the middle. This was clearly a big Macy's as its, you know, heyday. And it was bizarre. And there was little exhibits around the store, and it was supposed to be sort of a conversation about consumerism. But like some of the corners, there was one corner where there was beanbag chairs and there was just like weird noises happening. And that was the exhibit. And it was fascinating. And I loved it. And my husband and I actually went, I think, twice while we were there, because it was so interesting. We needed to go back see it again.
I remember the first time I saw an installation exhibit, like I was floored. It was like the 80s and it was some like Jenny Holzer thing. And I was like, oh my God, like this installation art, like what is this?
You
this
can
new?
Do this?
Like, I know, like, yeah. Wow.
I really love art that I don't understand, but can still appreciate it. I think that's part of what I liked about the Macy's thing. You appreciate it and you enjoy it and you like get something from it, but you don't really know what you're doing or what the artist was thinking. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You're a very open-minded viewer.
Thank you.
If that is your reality, you know, because I think a lot of people, viewers, go into art exhibits or museums or wherever they're going to see art with an idea of what art is, what art isn't, and to talk to you and for you to say, you know, I'm just going to take it all in and take my impression. Yep. It's very open-minded. I don't find people to be that way.
It's not always the case. Yeah.
I remember reading poetry in high school and having a moment where I asked a teacher what it was about or what it meant, and she wouldn't tell me. She was like, you know, it's whatever you get from it. And then later I wrote a poem and my teacher asked me what I meant by it. And I turned around and I gave her the same thing she gave me. I'm like, it's whatever you interpret it as.
That's so baller, Sarah. Right? That's
awesome. I like to think I'm very cool.
How did she react? Was she like, that's not how it works here?
Yeah, she was annoyed and she asked me again and made me tell her.
Oh, well.
Teachers. Yeah. Right? Gosh.
Thank you.
What do they expect?
I know. Never encouraged my inner, like, anarchist. I want to ask you about both graffiti, but also tattoos. And I feel like these are, like, connected enough where I can throw them all in at the same time. So you have a bunch of tattoos.
I do, and I'm getting one tomorrow.
Oh, that's great. So you are an artist who literally walks around with art on your body all the time,
exactly.
Which is very cool. Are any of them yours? Have you ever?
Lots of them are mine.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Lots of them. I just got one here that is mine. I started, you know, with the concussion art. And I was talking about the neon. So I started a series called Neon Faces. So I'm a recovering addict of many, many different addictions. But one of the biggest addiction is my food addiction. And that's the one that still sort of plagues me. And I had weight loss surgery like 4 years ago, and I lost 170 pounds.
Wow. Congrats.
Thanks.
Food That's addiction like a, is the hardest one because you can't avoid
you
food
can't,
forever.
Yeah.
You need it.
And once fat cells are evil, once they're there, they're always there, and they just want to get bigger. And that's all they want. Just feed me.
Yep.
But I was, you know, there's a little word in this, and it says dope. And I was thinking about, like, I've also had an opiate addiction, the way in my late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, you know, how people walk around. They're like, hey, man, that's so dope. Oh, you, dope. And I'm like, you know what? Dope is not so dope. And then I was thinking about my own food addiction. I'm like, that's not so fun. That's not, that, you know, that's a lot of self-hate and awfulness.
Yep.
So it's nice to hear you in the, your intro say that I'm I have a lot of positivity, because I've struggled a lot with negativity and sort of overcoming my own shortcomings. Mm-hmm. And about the tattoos. So I have a lot of tattoos of my own. This is the first one I did that is my drawing. And what I liked about this particular, it's a Hamsa for anyone that is listening. It's a Middle Eastern design that is the eye of God, I liked how when I made the drawing that finger was, it's my hand. It was in my hand. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a graphic designer. So it's not right. It's not, you know, it's like what the college professor said, just do it. Do it your way.
Yeah. And
so when I had it inked, the guy said, do you want me to fix that? And I said, no, I want that the way it is. It's my drawing. This leg is all my drawings.
That's so cool.
That feels very almost evocative of Where the Wild Things Are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I did a whole series called Beast Buildings and Storms, and it was all about sort of our beastly nature and the places we seek refuge and sort of the emotional storms that we go through. Mm-hmm. So I resonate very strongly with what you were just saying.
Yeah. Oh wow.
And my cat just died that I designed.
Sorry.
Oh, you guys are awesome for saying something. I reached out to a couple different tattoo artists that I know, and I'm like, I want to do this memoriam tattoo about my cat, but you know, I want to tell you what I want you to do. Mm-hmm. And so I did a little drawing of it and snapped it and sent it to him, and then I sent him a picture of my cat's eyes, and I was like, I said, I would like you to take my cat's eyes and put them in this cloud, and I want, my cat was all black, I was like, I want the cloud to be black with my cat's eyes, and then I want this pink lightning bolt, because I like flash, I like traditional tattoos, mm-hmm. but I wanted to do something for my cat. But there's a lot of times with the tattoos, like, I'm sorry, I'm kind of all over the place, but
I love it.
I lost 170 pounds and I wanted to have like skin reduction surgery. I wanted to go to a burn unit and say, take everything that you need. I will donate all my excess skin. But in trying to do that, they don't take skin in that way. So I thought, this is a great, I'm going to donate my skin. Yeah. It's going to go to a burn unit and somebody is going to be able to benefit from this thing that I think is so ugly. And then I just decided that opportunity wasn't available to donate my skin. So I said, you know what? I'm just going to put pictures on my skin. They're going to be my art and other people's art mm-hmm. that I like. And it just is what it's going to be. And I'm Jewish, and the tradition is to not have marks and tattoos mm-hmm. on your body, or mm-hmm. A lot of people have heard you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. So
right.
That's what I've already heard, always heard.
Yep.
I feel like they're
going to grandfather's Jewish and he does not like my tattoo.
My parents say I'm 53. Every time I see my parents, they comment on my tattoos.
Wow.
And my first one was when I've done this all in the last 6 years. So I started getting them before I did the weight loss surgery, but then the weight loss surgery prompted me to be like, More. Oh my God, look at all the skin.
Yeah.
I'm going to just fill myself up.
It's a canvas.
Yeah.
It is a canvas. And so I'm happy when I get other people's work on my body. I'm happy about that.
Graffiti.
Oh, graffiti.
I love graffiti. I don't really care if it's legal or illegal or if you call it, you know, if it's government sanctioned, it's public art, street art. Love graffiti. So I was telling Laura on the way here, we were talking about driving through Rochester. I love Rochester. I love underdogs in general. So Rochester's always been sort of my like, go, go, go.
Rochester, I have to say, I have to plug the Rochester Museum of Fine Arts.
Yes.
Matt Wyatt and the people that work with Matt are phenomenal. He has shown a number of bodies of my artwork and given me some really great opportunities right on Main Street. He's lit some pieces of mine that were censored. They ended up being censored. They were at the Holy Rosary Credit Union building.
Wow.
Or building that the Holy Rosary Credit Union owned. They didn't, the work had a lot of four-letter words. It was at street level. People wrote letters to the editor. Oh. The art came down. Luckily,
I heard this story, actually, from Matt.
From Matt.
Yeah.
So we knew when we put the show up, I said, Matt, the show is not going to, I said, what are we going to do? What are you going to do? What's your stance? And he said, the work's going to stay up. It's going to stay up as long as it can be up. And I said, Matt, the work's going to come down. They're going to censor it. And he's like, they're not going to censor it. It was interesting. The work was from the Beast Buildings and Storm series. So that is a series of 258 drawings that are all laid together top to bottom, end to end, to be a contemporary cave painting about sort of our, like I was saying before, our sort of animalistic nature and mm-hmm. how we proceed through life in these seeking refuge from who we are and our true nature. And that's the work that he was showing at the street. And, you know, a lot of the stuff I was saying was not, you know, was like, I want to kill you, you know, die, die, die. You know? a lot of very angsty kind of notions. And so graffiti for me, I don't know how to do graffiti. Like there are people that know how to hold a can of spray paint mm-hmm. and make beautiful things with
spray
paint.
How do they do it? Yeah. I don't even understand it. It's amazing.
I've seen them work and they are amazing.
Yeah.
When I hold a can of spray paint, I hold it like a clumsy 4-year-old.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing. I have no method. I don't know what I'm doing, but I love spraying. Yeah. It's so fun. You like can cover something and then like I love drips. So it's like I take one color and I like and saturate an area, watch it drip, and then I'm like, ooh, let's take another color. And then I just watch it. I don't know, some kind of magic something.
Matt's on our list of people to interview, and he's incredible. I'm like blown away by him. People think that Portsmouth is like the art hub of the seacoast, and I kind of disagree. And Rochester has this like, it's almost like two different cities. It's like this very conservative city, has a little bit of a bad reputation, and then has this just like glorious like grassroots art movement. And one of my favorite things, and I was telling Laura about this because I think it's so cool, one of my favorite things that Matt did or sort of Rochester did, this arts community, was took the boarded up windows and had an artist cover them in paint and then put them back up. And now we've got art on the street, like public art, to replace boarded up windows, which is both, you know, cool and efficient and pretty, but also like symbolic.
Absolutely.
Boarded up windows are like a sign of, you know, and he did the same thing with vacant storefronts too.
That's what I was talking about.
Yeah, that was where your art was.
And then then he did another vacant storefront across the street, and I had these paintings that were 6 feet by 5 feet, huge paintings, and he put like 5 of them in the window and lit them beautifully, and it was like, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like Paris.
Yeah,
like my artwork is in these giant windows, and it looked so good and so professional. And then what happened is the Rochester Performance and Art Space now is in the space that the Holy Rosary Credit Union. So my work was the first work in the window, and then they sort of got this idea that we want to do this performance and art space. And so Rochester already has the Rochester Opera House.
Yep.
River Stones is a gallery. After my work came down on the street in that empty storefront, the gallery owner across the street said, ooh, controversy, bring your art to my gallery. Oh. So she was fabulous. And Kristen invited me in. She hung up all the work. She said she didn't care what anyone had to say. She was supporting it. She was behind it. She sold a very expensive piece of artwork in her little frame shop.
Oh.
Somebody was looking for something edgy, and it was in a couple of different papers, and they saw it and they came in, they bought it.
Cool.
And it's like,
I love that.
I love it too, because they're, you know, where is the mark? There, You've seen my artwork. There's not a market for it. There's no, you know, there's nowhere that's, I don't know.
There might be a market, but it's kind of a weird market. I like those people.
It's not necessarily in New Hampshire right now.
No.
You know, there's a market in New York City, in like Austin, Texas, you know, like certain hubs, but you're this, you know, vibrant force that's not quite in any kind of box in the artist community. There's all these different boxes and levels of, you know, kind of the fine art of the, you know, State Street galleries in Portsmouth. Yeah. Just, you know.
I wish I could fit there because I want somebody to see to see the message, or to not even if there is a I don't even know if there is a message for everyone, but I want people to be confronted with the imagery and say to themselves, what is going on? Mm-hmm. And then luckily, if I'm lucky enough to have a conversation, I can say what I said to you all, that, wow, look at all, there are so many things that are in this environment that we don't see. I'm just compressing space, flattening it, and I'm showing you everything at once. And some people, that makes them very uneasy. There's so much going on. How do you decipher what, how do we even look at this? What are we seeing? There's words, what the words, I can't read all the words, they're crossed out. And, you know, people want to know, what is that? What is it all about? Mm-hmm. And for me, it's just trying to tap into sort of all the voices that are in the room. And I'm trying to give weight. I'm trying to give as much weight to things that I see as things that I don't see.
Yeah.
And I'm with the graffiti, it's more like a style than it is like a skill set.
Yeah.
I have done street art that I think somebody would call graffiti, but I want to take it out of that, the graffiti words, and I want to put a better spin on it. I want to call it street art.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
street art sounds so like legal and sanctioned.
It does, doesn't it? I'm not allowed to do the, I can't, yeah.
Yeah,
can't
graffiti's like the rule breaking word. Street art or public art is like when the government gives you the thumbs up first.
I tried in my street art graffiti history to say, I am a protest artist. This is actually protest art. This is not graffiti. And the police didn't go for it. They said, no, clearly you're painting on someone else's property. That is graffiti.
Yeah.
So I lost the battle.
They don't get the art.
They didn't. Actually, that's the thing, is the art was a little bit too loud. They didn't like the art. They got the art.
That's interesting.
But they didn't want the art.
Yeah. But they did, you were saying earlier, they gave you an alternative. You can't.
Exactly. Which you could. So my alternative, instead of painting on public structures, is to paint on whatever I choose and then put it out in the environment.
Mm-hmm. So you're taking your own large planks of wood or whatever surface and putting it out there.
Exactly.
Which is a good compromise. It's a good remedy. You're still getting the message out, but it's not going to affect someone else in a way where they feel violated.
Yeah. Exactly. I went to a friend's house. I was driving past her house, and on the side of the road was this mailbox. You've probably seen them. Huge mailboxes. They look like chicken coops. I don't know. Have you ever seen them?
Maybe. I've seen some weird ones.
And they're like in affluent areas where somebody has like this giant, like $5,000 chicken coop.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and there was one of these things on the side of the road. I pulled up into my friend's house and I was like, is that bizarre mailbox? Is that up for grabs? And she was like, oh, I'll take it away. Somebody dropped it here. They thought it was a joke, blah, blah, blah. I took it and I brought it to my studio and I was like, this is great. I love this thing. So I painted it yellow, and I was, my intention, I'm going to paint what I want to paint on it. I'm going to go to an intersection. I'm going to take it out of my car and I'm just going to drop it there and leave it there. And I did that, and I like ran across like three lanes of traffic, and I like Frogger. this thing was huge. I mean, I could barely carry it myself. It was, and really awkward. And I left it in the middle of this intersection. And I just took a picture of it and I posted it and I was like, you know, do you know where this intersection is? And people were like, oh my God, yeah, I saw that. I saw that piece. But I went back the next day and it was gone. And all it was a yellow like house thing. And it had like this little smiley gremlin on it that was Did you see it?
We just had a whole conversation about the Gremlins. We just
talked about the Gremlins today. She has a very dark past with the movie, and I just learned about it today. We had this, like, I don't know, 20-minute conversation about Gremlins. So,
and then we talked about it later again.
Yeah. Yeah, my husband, I told my husband about it, so it spurned another conversation.
I'm going to tell you, I've never seen the movie. What?
Well, we're going to have a viewing party, yeah, actually. Cool.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, she was very, very afraid of it as a child. It spurred multiple nightmares.
I watched it too young. Yeah. I don't know if watched is the right word. I was in the living room when my dad was watching it, and I have had so many nightmares where the thing that I think is the Gremlins, I don't know if it's really an accurate representation, have been in my dreams over and over and over again.
I feel like it's a Furby.
Absolutely, totally was inspired by that movie.
I did have a Furby.
You should be fine with Gremlins.
You would think, right?
Yeah. I have Furbies too. I collected them.
I never had one.
They weren't allowed. I worked for the National Institutes of Health. They were not allowed in government offices. Furbies, no government offices.
Why?
Because Gremlins.
Because they learn. Furbies learn. Like you could.
Oh, they repeat information?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
National security threat.
Not only do they repeat it, but you can teach it them. You can teach them like you can teach Siri.
Oh, my God.
So Furbies came out, like, in the 80s.
It influenced Siri and Alexa and all that.
Okay, Google. Well, I'm really glad that when you dropped off your mailbox chicken coop thing that you didn't get, like, picked up for littering. So. Yeah. This before the police were already after you?
This is before the police were after me for that thing.
Yeah.
The police have always been after me.
So I researched you on the internet before this. I did a little like Google stalking. And one of the things that I was most excited to talk about and to ask you about was this intersection of art and politics and environment and religion and how that sort of shaped your art, because you obviously are also maybe a political person and you care about the environment and you have a lot of like justice themes throughout your art, which I love. So I wanted to hear more about that.
Awesome. I think the thing that is the single impetus to some of my political artwork is injustice. I mean, it just burns me to the core. I don't know if you saw any of the images of my Black Lives Matter piece, but
I wish.
What happened is I had a conversation with a family member of mine who was raised in the same household that I was, who's 4 years younger, my younger sister, and she said the most racist comment to me. And I just lost it. And I didn't speak to my sister about it. I went out and I did the street art on this abutment in Rochester on Blackwater Road. And it was an American flag backwards with broken black hearts instead of stars. So I wanted to speak to the heartache that I feel as a white American, but that I also feel that every human who understands the word humane and must feel when they see an injustice. Mm-hmm. And I was just speaking about that one particular injustice, but I have a whole list of them. And I never know what injustice is going to piss me off the next time. So that, you know, what was going on at the time that I did the Black Lives Matter piece was that Trump had just been nominated for his party. The day that I was on the front page of the paper with my mural, he was above the fold and I was below the fold.
Wow.
And then that particular incident was in the newspaper 7 times over the course of 7 days. It was picked up by the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. It went to Bangor and it went to Boston. People were recognizing me from my mugshot. My mugshot was on TV and people were recognizing me in the White Mountains saying, "Were you that lady that did that?" And I depending upon what their face looked like, I either fessed up or no.
No, it wasn't me. Must have been my doppelganger.
That was so my twin.
I was getting some like high fives and cumbies, and then at some of the local like diners, I was getting evil looks. So some people loved it and love the fact that I am speaking out against this injustice, and other people were like, how dare you? And they were really people that were upset that I put hashtag Black Lives Matter. People were super upset about that. And they turned me into the police. They were so upset that they called the police. I wrote my initials on the piece. I was absolutely fine with saying, this is not right, and I want to start a conversation because this needs to be talked about. Because in the back roads in New Hampshire, a big truck went over a double yellow line and put his vehicle between me and the wall that I painted on. Got out of his car, spat on me. Flailing arms. We don't want these people here. We don't. I was like, sir, the police are coming and the Fosters is coming and a videographer and a photographer. You can tell them your whole story.
Yeah.
You, why don't you stay around for the police to come and for the video guy to come? Sir, we want to document your side of the story.
Wow.
How fast did he book it out of there?
Bat out of hell.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
All I said was the police, and he was like, out of here. And I was so shaken up that I didn't get any kind of identification, and he didn't get his truck plate. I was like alone on the side of this on the side of the road where I did this street art, and a friend of mine who at the time was a UNH professor, she is a Black woman, and I said, I want you to go take a look at this, and I want you to respond, because if something about this feels inappropriate to you, I've missed the mark, and mm-hmm. I need to rectify it. And she said she went to the spot where the art was created, and she felt unsafe in the spot with the wall saying Black Lives Matter. She felt uncomfortable as a Black woman to be in a rural road alone with that message. And wow. That is the kind of shit that gets under my skin mm-hmm. and incenses me, and I just burn. I will rehash it and play it, and you know, how can I break that boundary? How can I start that conversation? So I was actually happy that the piece was in the paper so many times, because people were talking.
It starts the dialogue.
people were talking, and just the fact that it was in, it was in the Fosters picked it up and it was like the front page, but then Janae McCartan, who does Gossip, picked it up and she did a whole piece in another part of the paper about it. And so then somebody wrote a letter to the editor. And so it was being spoken about in many realms. And I felt like, as a political artist, yes, I did my job.
Yeah.
But there's always things that are like burning. You know, I want to make art that challenges people. I just
love that. I love that you have a really good way to like get that anger out, whereas a lot of us are really angry and we don't really know what to do about it. And unfortunately, what that usually leads to is doing nothing about it, which is not the right thing to do.
Or just complaining on the internet.
Or complaining on the internet.
Which is not, you know...
It's Are you saying happens. That complaining on the internet isn't a productive...
It's an illusion of a dialogue, but a lot of times it's not, because it's just a lot of people screaming at each other.
And for those of us with thin skins, we just don't even bother. I don't even bother. Yeah. I can't...
I posted something on a Facebook page that said, post whatever the bleep you want. It's a local, and I mean, I'm very opinionated. Yeah. And if you did research on me, you know I just speak my mind. So I posted... that I am sick and tired of these paint nights. Like, why do people need to have...
I saw that. And I said, thank God.
The paint nights are always really bad.
So, can I tell you? that somebody said that that thread, that Facebook page had been dead, but there were 212 comments.
Oh, yeah.
And they shut me down. They prevented me from writing on the Facebook page that said, post whatever the bleep you want.
But if you do, we're going to censor you.
But and not even censor and shut. Like, I could, people were, they were dragging me through the mud. They said, I mean, every terrible thing about my mother and my, you know, everything. Terrible, terrible things about me.
And how does that affect you? Well, Does it roll off? Does it seep in?
You seem like someone with a thick skin.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, underneath it all, I don't have a thick skin. Yeah. And, you know, I cry like everybody else. But yeah. I was so tired of artists, people that I considered artists, going and teaching paint night. Like, teaching paint night. Like, yeah. And people were saying, you know, this is an authentic experience for me. I'm not an artist. I do want to go to paint night. And so my mind was changed. I read 212 comments and I thought, you know what? Paint night, it's okay, Beth. You give them paint night. They like paint night. Give them paint night. So I actually changed my mind about it. But I will not do paint night and I will not go to paint night.
I actually think you should run a paint night, but like turn it upside down and do it the way that it could be done.
They walk in thinking, hey, I'm going to have a painting just like the other 12 people here.
Yeah.
Wait a second.
That's what I don't like about it. How inspiring is it to paint the same? You're copying somebody else's painting and everybody's copying the same painting. Should do a paint night that's like, here, dip your hands in the paint and just do whatever feels good.
I love that. Yeah. So, but we have to.
I would go to that.
We have to call it something different than paint night, though, because the paint night, the expectation is, oh, teacher's going to teach me how to mix orange, and I'm going to make an orange sunset
while drinking wine, rosé.
Something that's similar to paint night, like a little like catchy, like paint fight or like
paint fight. I like that.
Oh, that's awesome. Let's bring have a paint it. Fight. Yeah,
bring it.
That's great.
The other thing I just wanted to say about the political art is that I never considered myself a political artist until I started speaking out about the current president. Like, I was very, very moved that this man was elected.
Yep.
And I was very moved that all of these little groups started springing up to speak their truth, and that there was this hate speech going on, mm-hmm. and I got really incensed. And I, you know, I was talking to a lot of people who are considerably younger than I am, so people that were in their 20s, and people that were telling me that they cried. They couldn't leave the house. This man was elected president, and oh my God, the world's going to And I just, I had never made any political art, and it just started seeping out everywhere and everything. Like, I just was like, are you proud? Like, is your family proud? Are you doing something for people? Are you helping people? Or, you know, I
think a lot of people will be able to relate to that sentiment. And I think I was in denial for a while, and I kept saying, oh, how bad could it be? Oh, it can't get any worse than this. And then it just kept getting worse.
Yeah.
I think the single best, it feels even bizarre to even call it like a silver lining, but he, number 45, clearly enraged so many people into this like inspired, empowered like revolt. That's kind of beautiful.
It is.
And we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that. And that's, again, it feels weird to say it, mm-hmm. and it feels a little icky to say it, and I feel a little icky saying it, but it's so cool to see people like use their rage. And we wouldn't rage. If
that's why we liberated Nazi Germany, right?
I was just saying that. Yeah.
That's all I kept, as a Jewish person, all I kept thinking about is Nazi Germany. You are going to send me to the ovens. And then I did that's where the religion part comes in.
Yeah.
I started to do a lot of a lot of artwork about maybe being Jewish, or, you know, Judaism is about practice, and it's really the same thing as all religions. Be your excellent self. Be your most excellent self.
Yes.
And also be excellent to each other. Yep. You know, and so I started feeling like, as a Jewish artist, I wanted to speak out against things that I did not believe, and I wanted to put them in. I wanted to turn the tables, and I wanted people to see that, you know, this kind of hate that 45 is up to is no different than what people were, 12 million people succumbed to,
yeah,
in World War II. So I was making a lot of those inferences myself. Then it was happening also in the press. I was reading things where people were also just comparing those ideologies. And, yeah, you know, this Make America Great and, you know, the Nazi regime. It was all coming together to me. And I was feeling like I was going to the ovens. If these people are in power and they say that I said or did something, they can certainly just put me away and shut the door and make me disappear.
And that goes back to the lost people.
Absolutely.
It's very cyclical.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because that it goes back to injustice too, because mm-hmm. if somebody has to take the initiative and speak up. And this is why I say that I'm a polarizing kind of person, because I will stand up and I will say, this is wrong. Or if I don't believe in something that you've said or something that you've done, I might call you out in your house. You know, I'm not stopped just because I'm in public. I don't censor myself. I usually say what I mean, and then I say it a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I keep saying it. People started saying more things that I was a political artist, and I started doing more political art because people said that I was, mm-hmm. That I had a more political tone to me. And the artwork that I was doing that was of a political nature began really satisfying me in terms of, I am outraged, and I need to be outraged, and I want to do a piece of art about being outraged, and I like that. Feels authentic. Mm-hmm. That feels like real art. That feels like content. You know, I have something to say. You know, I'm not, a lot of my other artwork, you know, there are religious themes because I was brought up that way. And I went to Hebrew school 3 times a week. I went to Friday night services. I went to Saturday services. I went to Sunday school. I lived at the Jewish Community Center. I was all involved. And my parents taught me, and my family members, this is why I was so outraged by my sister, but taught us, you accept everyone for who they are. And my parents were very specific. And they said to us when we were children, if you don't like blacks, you don't like Jews. If you don't like Jews, you don't like Polish people. If you don't like Polish people, you don't like people with red hair. You know, this is, we can't just not like somebody because of some arbitrary something. Let me not like you because you're cruel. Let me not like you because you're a jerk. But I'm not going to dislike you because of the way you look. I don't dislike someone who has a different opinion. Let's have a conversation.
How they use it.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
What
exactly.
They do with it.
Right. Like choosing to spit on you when you're standing next to your art, not the way to disagree with someone.
Or to put hand, to push.
Yeah.
Like, here's this New Hampshire guy with, and I'm thinking concealed carry.
Yep.
Like, I'm thinking I'm going to lose my life over a piece of art that I did about Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
After the incident with the gentleman that drove over the double yellow line, the spitter. We'll just refer to him as the spitter. So, yeah, disgusting, right? So I was thinking, like, you know, what about my life? What's the value of my life? What's my value of my life as an artist? What if I was imprisoned? What would I say? Would I still say, if it comes down to my life, is this worth it? And I was like, absolutely worth it. They, initially, a lawyer came forth, and said, pro bono, I'll take your case. This is ridiculous. And initially he said, this is no problem. Mm-hmm. You're 50 years old. You're an artist. It's protest art. And they came back and they said to my lawyer, she's going to jail. She's going to jail for a year. You're not getting out of this. And the lawyer came back to me and said, Beth, you're going to go to jail for a year. And I was like, what? All of this was coming to a head. And I was like, what is going on here? And people were saying, well, you should have talked to me before you put your name on it. And I was like, what do you mean before I put my name on it? No, I say this.
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
That they didn't tell you not to do it, just not to put your name on it.
Yeah.
The police said the same thing.
Really?
They said you shouldn't have signed it.
What was the charge? Just vandalism, vandalism, right?
And vandalism, but it was like, it was the tier. It was a felony charge because the damage that was done was above over a certain
dollar amount. Yeah.
But the reason why it was that dollar amount was not for the work that the art that I made. It was because there were some spray paint wars going on, and people would come by, cross out the word black with white paint, and then somebody else came by, and then they threw a bucket of paint on the mural.
So it created a consistent environment of it.
And people were just angry. And if you go through and you Google if you say Beth Wittenberg images and go like through them, you'll see the one image that was taken at right before they painted it over. They painted it just gray. Mm-hmm. And it looks a mess. It looks like somebody had a war over that piece of wall. And like buckets of paint thrown and things crossed out and things written and things crossed out. And this is just because I tagged it Black Lives Matter. Somebody was very upset that the American flag was backwards. That's why he reported me to the police. Mm-hmm. He did not like the backwards American flag. And I was like, they have it on military uniforms. I don't know. It was all a big thing. I'm glad they told me don't do it again. The charges were dismissed. That was the end result. So they didn't take me for a year. They dismissed the charges, and then somebody came forward and paid the fine anonymously. So
if you're listening, thank you.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. And kudos to that attorney.
Yes.
That's special.
Yeah. He actually is also a musician. So he, I think, was coming at it from an artist's point of view.
Yeah.
Cool. We can interview him, too.
He's fantastic.
We're going to go through all of Hampshire and expand.
Sometimes I think to myself, what sort of genre do I fit in? And am I an abstract expressionist? Am I a graffiti artist? Am I a neo-expressionist? Am I this, am I that? Am I outsider artist?
Right.
And none of it matters. All it matters is that I'm passionate.
Yeah.
I have something to say, and I like to make things.
I think that I would feel, I often joke that this presidency has taken years off my life because I'm so stressed and I keep everything inside, and I feel like I would feel lighter if I had some way to like push it out. And it doesn't even matter to me what that way is. I just need to like get it out. I'm very envious of you. Just like, you just get it out.
We need to do a collaborative thing.
I love it.
Where you come over and let's just get you doing something.
I love it.
That's one of the things that I am really passionate about creating with other people. Because, you know, I'm in my head all the time, and I know the content that I live with, mm-hmm. but I don't know what you're about. And, you know, we have one conversation and we can connect this much. But
yeah.
Making art is like a dance, mm-hmm. especially when you make art with another person.
Yeah.
And like, you step in, I step out. You erase what I did, I erase what you did. You make something new based off of what I did, you know. We develop a whole new language together. And that process of creating with another human being is so, it's so invigorating for me. I love it so much. And I love when other people say like, sure, I'm going to take you up on that. I'm going to come over and we're going to make art. Yeah. So please know that it's for real, anytime. Anytime, you're welcome to come over, and I will provide all the materials, and we'll get messy.
I love it. I can already picture myself saying, Beth, is this right? And you being like, yeah.
Heck yeah.
Whatever it is, it's right.
Oh, that's
Am am I doing thing. It right?
That's awesome.
Do you think you would say that?
I think I would. I absolutely would.
But somebody like me who, like, you look at my artwork and there's no, I mean, there's no right or wrong. You don't even know if the piece is upside down or right side. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's interesting to know that because, like, I don't know if it's right or wrong when I do it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's good or bad or it just is.
Should we do rapid fire?
These are going to be questions that we're just going to shoot at you. And, you know, just one word or one sentence answers, you know, just first thing.
Okay.
What other artists have influenced you the most?
Locally, I am absolutely in love with Andy Heck Boyd.
Do you ever think about quitting?
I never, ever think about quitting.
I knew the answer to that.
Such a good answer.
Yeah. You know what I think about, though? They wanted to know about my studio practice. And I was saying, you know, when you're in the practice of creating, creating becomes easier.
Yes.
If you stop creating.
Yes.
And you say, you know, like how you've been out of the studio. It gets scary for artists to go back in the studio and take that first step.
Usually
it's really
first,
scary.
My first day back is usually one of frustration. And like, wait, come on. Just, it's like almost, you know, getting back into exercise without stretching.
It's funny because that made me think about rock climbing. Yeah, being out of rock climbing for a little bit makes me scared to go back because I'm like, I have to start all over again.
Yeah.
But the longer I wait, the harder it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Favorite color?
Pink. Pink is all about the love.
Favorite scent?
Probably a fire. I like the scent of a fire.
That's a good one. Favorite sound?
The thing that came to me was wind chimes.
Uh-huh.
But that's not my favorite sound. I think I like the sound of the breeze. I think I like something a little calming and maybe not something as tonal.
Favorite texture?
I like 100% cotton. I'm like 750 thread sheets.
It's a nice feeling.
That is nice.
Yeah, I just, something opulent and comfy.
If you could go back in time and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give yourself? Art related or not, whatever you prefer.
Don't say no. Just say yes. Say yes to everything. That I think that's what I, because I've been a scaredy cat most of my life. So I'm while I'm a big risk taker in sort of the art scene, I'm not that big a risk taker emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I would try to tell myself to go for it. If somebody invites you somewhere and you're a little bit nervous, just go. Say yes. Mm-hmm. Just do it.
I love that. That's awesome.
That's a great answer.
Thanks. Yeah. We appreciate you being on this so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
It's been really wonderful.
Thank you. For me as well.
Show us your creative guts.
Yes! That's awesome.
That was very good.
That's so good.
Right? Gotta get the motivation.
Beth and I need to get together to make some art stat.
Yes.
I had forgotten about how empowering and therapeutic this conversation was for me. Her process as an artist is so natural and intimate, and I have so much appreciation for how she uses her art to communicate with the world and create characters, as she puts it.
She is so vibrant and positive and forward-thinking, and it was just such a treat to talk with her. It really was infectious. I remember after this interview, I raced to the studio the next day to work on art because other artists really do motivate you, I think. So thank you, Beth. We really appreciate you being on our podcast, especially in its infancy when you didn't quite know what to expect. Folks out there, you should check out Beth's work because it is so powerful and moving, and I feel like everybody can draw something from it. Check out Beth's work at www.bethwittenberg.com or at bethwittenberg.artist on Facebook. And if you want to be kind of lazy, just head on over to our Facebook page and we'll have the links right there for you to just do a simple click. We are at Creative Guts Podcast on Facebook. You will find those links, photos with Beth, and other links to all our other guests and upcoming news of who's going to be coming down the pipeline. Thank you, as always, for listening, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
There's a way, and I
can't. No, I can't.
Well, then
do
we're
it.
Stopping right now.
Oh,
yeah, that's right. You can
anything for you, Laura.
Yeah. And actually, can you bring the whole bag in?
No,
because you're such a pain.
Very needy.
That's what you get for sitting by the door.
We needed some airflow anyway. Thank you for opening.